Tonight, in conjunction with Misty Kiesler-Haunt, the sociologist, Dr. Margie Kerr, is here to present Scream, Why We Love or Loathe Thrills and Chills. With a BA from Hollins University in Roanoke, Virginia, and a PhD in sociology from the University of Pittsburgh, where she now does her research and teaches, Margie Kerr has developed a significant reputation for her work on fear, specifically how and why we engage with that which frightens us. She is the co-investigator on a groundbreaking study that measures how the brain and body respond to what she calls, quote, fun, scary, end quote, experiences. And this experience and insight has put her at the center of the discussions on the science or the psychology, I guess more accurately the science, but I keep thinking of it as the psychology of fear, with interviews and reviews with publications and programs such as Rolling Stone, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, NPR's Hidden Brain, which is one of my favorites, and locally Think on KERA. Some of you may have heard that interview a few years back. She has also contributed to significant publications, including the New York Times op-ed, Slate, Psychology Today, and Salon. Her book, Scream, Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear, has stirred a great deal of interest. It was named as a must-read by the Washington Post. All of this, of course, points to Margie's connection to Misty Kiesler-Haunt. She is, in fact, one of two authors for the monograph that accompanies the exhibition, with her essay titled Behind the Screams, Applying Research Findings to Kiesler's Photographs That, as Seen in the Second Floor Galleries, Beautifully Exploit and Carefully Point to Nuanced Aspects of Haunted Houses and the Actors Who Animate Them. Given the topic and Margie's expertise, I think this is going to be very interesting. So if you would, please join me in welcoming Dr. Margie Kerr.
Hi, everyone. Thank you all so much for coming out tonight, and so many thanks to The Modern for inviting me, especially to Misty. I'm so honored to be part of her incredible book and the work, the exhibit. If you haven't seen it, you really should go and check it out. It's really beautiful. So I am just very happy to be here tonight and talk to you all about fun, scary stuff, and some of the science behind why we do or do not like this type of material. One point about this photo that I have up here, this is one of my favorite photos, and it's actually a favorite among many of my affective scientist friends and colleagues, because it's such a genuine capture of expression, you know, of, in this case, kind of fun, scary, of fear. And you can see the variety of responses and just a hint of a smile in the girl on the far right. And then the gentleman's just sort of dazed, kind of caught in a headlight. But I love this photo, and I think it really just captures the range of expression that we see doing these types of activities. So backing up a little bit, I wanted to try and understand why people do scary things. You know, why would we voluntarily go out and pay money and spend time to scare ourselves? And I was asking this question because my background is in looking at fear as a primarily toxic force in society. You know, this is just kind of some screen grabs from headlines. And as you guys all experience on a daily basis, a lot of our media coverage is inundated with messages of fear, even when they don't necessarily need to be, when there's no immediate threat, or when it's a news story that isn't tied to fear, but the journalist will choose very clickbait kind of words and inciting language to draw attention to the coverage and to get viewers. And the same thing happens with consumer products and political agendas. Whenever people want to try and motivate us to you know, move us to act, to either to buy or to vote, using fear to incite that is pretty effective, and we see it constantly. And this isn't a new thing. We've been using fear to motivate since the dawn of human history. The one on the right here, Join or Die, that was by Benjamin Franklin back during the Revolutionary War, trying to motivate people to, you know, join the revolution. And so the practice of using scary images or just fear in general has long, long history. And I teach a sociology of fear class, and right now we're looking at Alexander the Great and some of his writings when he was traveling through India, and the descriptive language that they would use, the you know, encountering bats with human teeth and, you know, sea monsters with six heads and all these magnificent kinds of stories, largely to, you know, not only build the sense of accomplishment for the troops who survived those excursions, but to just motivate interest in general. So we've been using fear for a long time to try and pull people into action. And today, with the changing way that we receive information, this has had some potentially unintended consequences, namely, you know, raising the question of whether or not we're really afraid of the right things. When we look at how we're getting information today, it's much more immediate. So if you go back even 50 years, we would get news more slowly. We might get the daily news through the radio or at the broadcasts in the morning or in the evening. 50 years before that, it would be, you know, the daily newspaper. Today, we get immediate updates on our phones and on our devices. So I remember when the Newtown shooting happened, I was in a meeting, and we all were getting the you know, text messages or just, you know, alerts on our phone, and everybody just stopped. And for the rest of the day, we were consumed with following the events as they were unfolding in real time. And that is very different for us. And it's creating this kind of emotional connection, this sense of urgency, this sense of involvement that doesn't really actually represent reality in a way. You know, we're feeling connected and engaged in this terrifying situation, yet we have no ability to control that situation, and we have no direct involvement, but we're still bound up in it. That's having some consequences to how we perceive threat and how we think about fear. Because then what happens is we, you know, talk amongst ourselves. We, you know, go to our trusted news outlets. We watch mostly the same TV shows, you know, on a daily basis. And we end up with a dire misperception of what we should be fearing. And this happens through a couple different mechanisms. So there's a concept called familiarity, which, you know, you may be familiar with. But basically, the more you see something, the more familiar it becomes, the more you start to think that it is a real problem. A go-to example of this is typically around Shark Week, when all of a sudden you start hearing about more and more shark attacks, or the media decides to start covering more shark attacks. And so you think, oh my gosh, what's going on with sharks? They must be having a frenzy. But in reality, it's just that the media are mentioning it more. Then even though we have more choice in where we get our news, we do typically go to the same places. If you just think to yourself right now where you get information, it's probably just a handful of websites, a handful of TV channels that you go to regularly. We don't veer from that too much unless we're intentionally trying to diversify our news sources. So there's the perception that you're getting a lot of different viewpoints, but we're actually getting them from very few. And they typically are now outlets that already vibe with a lot of our other beliefs and worldviews. So because we have greater choice in where we get our entertainment and information, we are choosing to go, you know, to places that already are in line with confirming what we believe. And this has a real problem because then you end up with what's called, you know, confirmation bias. You think that because you're hearing things you believe repeated back to you, that it confirms your beliefs, when really it's just this echo chamber cycling around and around and around. And this leads to another concept I'll mention briefly called group polarization, where because we're stuck in these echo chambers, we end up moving to the extremes and digging our heels in even deeper because we have a sense that what we believe, what we keep seeing, and what we keep hearing confirmed is such a big problem. We need to have even more intense beliefs and feelings and lack of rigidity around it. And this also is different than the world that, you know, we've lived in for many years, because everyone was forced to listen to the same handful of news programs and TV channels. You know, you had your main networks and that was it. So, you know, when people sat down to watch TV, everybody across, you know, ethnic groups and religious backgrounds and socioeconomic status had to watch pretty much the same thing. So you were actually getting more diverse viewpoints in a lot of ways than you do today, where everyone just goes off into their own spaces. So this leads to a misperception of what we should be afraid of. We're afraid of the things that we're hearing from a more narrow perspective. And this is problematic because then we don't really pay attention to the things that probably we should. So when we look at what we really should fear, and this is just a chart I'm not going to go through, I just am putting it up there as kind of a reference point. But, you know, when we look at our actual risk, it's going to be very different based on where you live, based on, you know, how old you are, based on your life experiences, based on your income. All of those things are going to influence what the biggest threat is to you right now. But a lot of people don't really take the time to look at that and find out, okay, what is really you know, going to threaten my well-being, my livelihood, my community's livelihood. And, you know, today a lot of those things are chronic, are long-term, and more abstract and harder to wrap our minds around. It's very easy to see a bear charging at you and know, I need to deal with that bear. Today it's like, oh, I got to deal with climate change, and that's becoming a lot more real for a lot of people very quickly. Or I've got to deal with, you know, chronic illness or heart disease or these things that are so far away that it's hard to really appreciate the threat that they may be presenting to us. Or, for example, something that I really that I don't hear a lot about, and I keep looking for it, is distracted driving. So I don't know if you guys have heard about this, but just in the past 2 years, motor vehicle deaths. So this isn't even accidents; these are mortality figures have increased 14%. That's more. That's the first time in half a century. And so this is, you know, pretty much since. You know, if we go back 25 years, we haven't been driving to the same extent that we have these past 25 years. You know, in the early years where cars were only affordable to, you know, smaller demographics. But now a lot of people can have access to cars, and we're seeing a great increase in deaths in the last 2 years. And you don't think about it too much. And that's because a lot of people, when they get into their car and they check their cell phone or they, you know, respond to a text, we do it so many times without any incident. We start believing that it is safe when actually it's really it's very problematic. So this is a little kind of pet project of mine, just trying to increase awareness on distracted driving, because it is one of those things that is having a huge impact. So here we are living in this world where we're just inundated with all of these very terrifying messages, and now you have me telling you to be scared about more things. And it just feels like, why would we ever ever want to go and voluntarily do scary things. You would think that we would want to run the opposite direction. And for some people, that is what they do. They say, I just don't want to deal with any of it. You know, I don't want to do anything scary, and that's fine. And we can talk about, you know, individual differences later if you want. But a lot of people do want to do scary things, and they come in many, many, many different forms. And I'll talk to a lot of people who will say, "Well, I don't like scary stuff. You know, that's just not for me." But then they're, you know, downhill skiers. I was in Leadville, Colorado last week, and out there, you know, lots of extreme sports are really popular. And you know, I would ask them, "Well, why would you do that? Why would you go barreling down a hill at breakneck speeds with the threat of injury and, you know, all of these things that rationally would seem pretty dangerous or scary to do, we choose to do them." So there's lots of different ways that people engage with what we call high arousal negative stimuli. And it's very popular in the U.S. And I want to note that that's not true in all cultures, in all countries. When I was in South America, they do not have high levels of engagement with this kind of material. It exists. You know, there are zombie movies and there are horror drama TV shows and very, very, very few haunted attractions. But they're not popular. You know, they don't do well in ratings. They usually last only a season. They're not breaking records like It at the box office. So this is something that varies by culture. And begs the question of, you know, why in the U.S.? Why is this happening right now? And I think that, well, I'm about to tell you why I think it is, based on some of my research and just lots of studies in psychology and history and across different disciplines. The first reason that we may be engaging with some of these scary kind of activities and scary material is that we do have this attraction to things that are novel, to things that are a little bit dangerous, that are a little bit scary. And there's good, you know, reasoning for that if we think about it from an evolutionary perspective. And I just want to note that this is one of Misty's portrait photographs. And, you know, we see something like this and we're attracted to it. We want to try and figure it out. We want to look at it and think, well, what is happening here? You know, and this is our brain trying to process this image that has human characteristics but also animal characteristics. And the way that our brain works, the way that we make sense and construct reality, is by pulling on our experience, pulling on our explicit knowledge, things that we know, and things that we expect. And here we have something that's violating all of those things. It doesn't fit in any category that we have. And that immediately is going to say, okay, we need to investigate because we need to know whether or not this is something that's going to hurt us, or potentially it could be something that could help us. So if you think of who we're descendants of, we're descendants of, you know, humans who had that motivation to go out and seek and explore. They had a curiosity, a sense of bravery that said, you know what, I want to go and see what is out there. I want to go look at that new thing. I want to, you know, pick it up and turn it over and maybe taste it and see what it's about. And those ancient humans, along with the humans who had the wisdom to learn when they saw, you know, their friend do that and then die, they said, okay, well, I don't want to do that. So the wisdom to say, okay, that I'll leave alone, or the wisdom to fight or flee, that's who we're descendants of. So we have this inherent kind of motivation to go out and explore and understand things that are different, things that are novel, things that are weird. But at the same time, we also experience a sense of repulsion. So it's this push and pull. You know, something is different, something is weird, something looks maybe dangerous. We're attracted, but we're also repulsed. And you see that a lot in the haunted attraction designs. It's these things that are inviting you in, but then saying, be careful, watch out. And so that can feel, we'll talk about the physiology behind it, but that can kind of, you know, pull us in, but then make us a little bit weary. And we, again, it goes back to this desire to understand. You know, I have a lot of people who will ask me if it's weird to read and want to engage with the stories of serial killers or just horror movies in general, and parents be like, should I worry that my kid's room is, you know, painted black and he's got all these books on like the occult and, you know, all this kind of weird stuff around? And I say, well, you know, everything in context, but the desire to know about this type of stuff is not in and of itself problematic, because, you know, when we go to some place someplace that looks like atrocity has happened or murder and mayhem and brutality, part of wanting to engage with that is a desire to understand something that we don't, to think, how could someone be so mean? How could someone be so cruel? How could these atrocities happen? Because it's not something that we see in ourselves. And so it's this desire to understand and to engage with it, because on the other side of that, we're reminded that we are not that, you know, that we, you know, ideally, are full of compassion, are full of caring, are full of understanding. And it may seem counterintuitive, but by engaging in things that are dark, you are reminded of things that are light. So by seeing things that, you know, are brutal and hard, you're reminded of some of the softer sides and some of the more caring sides of life. So when I talk about why, you know, there's a whole kind of discipline or a research agenda called dark tourism, understanding why people go to places of atrocities, and this is mentioned a lot, that you know, it is through engaging with scary material that we're reminded of some things that are righteous and good in humanity. So there, that's the kind of broad level of it, but there is, you know, another level that I have, you know, been learning about and researching now for about 10 years, and that is what's happening in the body when we're afraid. And one of the very first questions that I had when I started looking at fear through this different lens was, you know, well, what is fear? I mean, how do we define it? When you go to the sociology journals, fear is defined very differently than when you go into the psychology or the physiology or the cognitive neuroscience. Everybody is defining fear differently. And so I started with just trying to see what does fear look like in the body? And so, you know, iconic kind of photo from The Shining. When we are afraid, we've got some things that we are used to seeing or hearing about with a fight or flight response. We jump, we run, we freeze. But that's only part of it. There are many different responses that we can have when we're afraid. These are just some of the more common ones that we see, each with their own evolutionary benefits. Other things that happen, you know, we scream, our mouths open, you know, could be to warn others, could be to, you know, scare whatever's attacking you. Our body is kicking into high gear, so our heart rate is increasing, our metabolism is just kind of putting the pedal to the metal. We're trying to convert all available energy or all available sugars into energy, get that out to our muscles. We've got our hormones that are being released to aid in that. We've got lots of different neurotransmitters that are released in our brain, like dopamine and we've serotonin. We've got endorphins that are released because typically if we're in a high-stress environment, we might get hurt, so we want to make sure that we're not feeling any pain. So endorphins are going to help with that. Our eyes widen, our pupils dilate, so our vision is changing. We've got sweat that's trying to cool our body down as our body is burning all of this energy. We're breathing faster, getting in as much oxygen as possible. We might show our teeth, maybe to appear more aggressive. We might flare our nostrils. All of these things are happening. And what you'll notice here is that the bubbles are popping up on both sides of the screen. So there's Jack, who is the aggressor, the one who is doing the scaring, and then Shelley, who is being scared. And you might think, well, aren't there specific responses, physiological changes that would differentiate these two experiences? And the answer is not really. You know, at a physiological level, these high stress states look very similar. So regardless of whether you're the one doing the scaring or the one being scared, your body is going to be in a similar state, you know, fully activated. And the way that we talk about this frequently in affective science and kind of studying emotions is by talking about valence and arousal. So we're not going to get into the weeds with this. I just want to put this up here to contextualize the more fun graphic that's on the next page. But if we think about arousal, and most people think about arousal in just a sexual sense, and yes, that's one form of arousal, but arousal at a physiological level is really just talking about how activated the body is. So, you know, what kind of hormones are and neurotransmitters and what kind of changes are getting the body into that go mode. So it's sympathetic nervous system activation, ready to just do anything. On the other end, we've got the parasympathetic activation, where we're just not doing anything, we're not digesting, we're maybe just sort of ready to go to sleep. And then on the x-axis, we have valence, which is basically just good or bad. So how positive or negative do we feel about something, or just how positive or negative in general is the kind of temperature, if you had to take your emotional temperature, if it's positive or negative. So when we think about fun with fear, I like to use this, and I do a lot of actor training, and I use this instead of the previous one, and it is just a lot more fun, and I think it is amazing how much is communicated with just emojis. But when we think about what's happening when we're scared in a haunted house, we can think about it like the ghost face at the top. You know, the startle happens, the air cannon is blast, the strobe is flashing, and we jump, we scream, our bodies are thrown into that threat response, which just is, you know, everything kind of going into activation. And then within milliseconds, we remember, we're with our friends, we're safe, we're not truly in danger. It's not a real bear. It's not a real serial killer. And we switch over to this one. And we're like, oh, wait. And then we start laughing. And we're like, oh, my God, this is ridiculous. This is so crazy. I can't believe that, you know, the actor just got me, or that there's this massive, you know, clown face coming towards me. All of that. And then, you know, you're crying and laughing with your friends. You're afterwards feeling pretty, you know, cheerful. Your body is still coursing with all of the feel-good chemicals that now you can interpret in a positive way. Because you know you're not really in danger, you can, just hijack kind of the threat response and enjoy it, because your body's not working to fend off any pain. It's not working to pay attention to a real threat. You can just sit back and kind of enjoy it. When my colleague and I do our studies pre and post with the extreme attractions that really kind of tax the body at an even higher level, many of them do kind of have this dazed look, this almost euphoric state, and their brain activity would suggest the same. And I'll get to some findings a little bit later. So this is, you know, when I talk to actors, when I talk to people about why they might like to be scared, it's typically because they're up here in this quadrant, and they know they're safe, they're having a good time. They're not over here where real threat and anger and concern live. And this is also why, you know, in haunted attractions, typically whenever I do surveys and whenever I talk to people about what kind of attractions they like, it's not attractions where actors are rude, where actors make comments about somebody's, shape or comments about their size, anything that is going to trigger a sense of embarrassment, a sense of shame, a sense of sadness really is not in the fun, scary category. And, some attractions get this, others don't, and they might think that that kind of thing is scary, but really it gets people down here. And once they're down here, it's very hard to get back up here, physically and emotionally, psychologically. So this is kind of what is occurring in the body in these fun, scary moments. And then we've identified, the boundaries around when fear is fun, when we can use these experiences intentionally for growth and for enjoyment. And it's when it's voluntary, and ironically, it's when it's safe. So here are two more photos from Misty's book, and here we have, what appears from a distance, and if you're going through it and you're in the dark, you might think it's a real fire, but it's a fake fire. Or things that look like they're going to fall over, but they're not. So these conditions of it being voluntary and safe are really foundational to fun scary. And voluntary is, of course, maintaining that sense of agency. So you have chosen to do this experience. You've chosen to purchase a ticket or to go with your friends, to sit down and see a movie. You know that you can leave at any time. No one is forcing you to be there. And that you maintain kind of control throughout the experience. You have a good idea of what is going to happen. And the safety piece is also crucial, and also one of the hardest things to explain to haunted attractions when I'm, doing consulting or training, trying to explain how important safety is, because I've heard comments like, oh, well, we want to make people feel like they're in danger. And that's the key, is feeling like they're in danger is very different than actually being in danger. And so I use this analogy, awareness and attention is also important, for set design in a different way that I'll address. But when you go to a local county fair and, they have the thrill rides that they set up, and these are the rides that are going from town to town every week. And I was telling Misty earlier, when I grew up, my mom was always very, very diligent about making sure that these rides were safe and that I was paying attention to, the dangers, the lurking threats at these local county fairs, because they were often the site of injuries. And so awareness and attention are two very different things. So you're walking around this fair, and you may notice that there's a toolbox on the ground, and there's some wrenches that are just kind of scattered about. And you may, walk by a ride attendant and smell, some whiskey, or maybe they look like they've had a kind of rough night. And then you're getting in line, and you hear the creaking, and you start wondering if this is even safe at all. And that's happening because our awareness is far more vast than our attention. So awareness is kind of the global idea of what is happening in this space around you. And we've got so many different systems at work that are constantly processing that information. So temperature, I have an awareness of where the exits are. I have an awareness of movements that are happening in the audience. I have an awareness of the lighting. So all of this is being processed, but I'm not paying attention to it. My attention is on, my words that I'm saying and speaking this right now. That's where my attention is. But that doesn't mean that my attention can't shift if something in my awareness kind of raises a red flag and is like, you need to pay attention to this. And then my attention is going to shift. So in a haunted attraction or, during these fun, scary kind of activities, our awareness is processing all of this information and giving us clues as to whether we're safe or not. And as soon as our attention is targeted, is grabbed by something that is considered unsafe or that is out of place, we're going to start looking for more signs of that. Some of this has to do with what I was talking about earlier about, wanting to investigate novel things, wanting to look at things that are different and somewhat dangerous. Is we do have a negativity bias. So if you show someone a picture of a flower in a car accident, we're going to go look at the car accident first and look at it longer because that's the thing that is scary, that is more important. We've processed it just so fast that we're not even consciously aware of it, that this is the thing that's important. So in an environment where there are these signs that there's not safety, we're not going to be able to lean into the experience, to actually suspend our disbelief and feel a sense of full immersion, because there's going to be a part of us still looking out for those dangerous signs. So in haunted attractions, these are things like nails sticking out from the wall, or actors behaving in an unprofessional manner, or actors breaking character. And then this is also why the detailed sets are so important. For those of you who've never been to really high-end haunted attractions, the difference between a high-end attraction like the ones in Misty's book and kind of the backyard black plastic, the difference is vast. And it's because in an environment where our awareness is taking in all of this, a distressed wallpaper, a photo, a blood pool on the ground that you're only seeing for a half a second, you're not paying attention to it, but your awareness is telling you that you are in this fully immersive space and you feel that realism. If you can see kind of the wrappers from the actor who's back there on a break, or if you can see there was an actor who thought it was a good idea to eat a can of tuna on their break in their scene. Those smells pull us real fast. Those type of things are going to register and pull us out of an experience. But if it's safe, if everything is in place and it's professional, we can kind of lean in. And the example I have on the other side here, I did the CN Tower Edgewalk, which is a 117-story structure in Toronto. It's the tallest structure in the Western Hemisphere. And before I went up, I was really just kind of in awe of the security measures that are in place. We had to do breathalyzer. We had to take off our clothes and put on the jumpsuit and their shoes. They also do a swab for explosives, a metal detector, lots of directions. And then when you're up there, you're attached by two separate wires, which are then zip tied. And I'm thinking, my God, this is kind of overkill. Like, what is happening here? But all of it was so necessary, because the moment that I stepped out on that ledge, I never felt fear like that. My body just took over completely. And everything in me said, I'm not a bird. I can't fly. This is wrong. I'm going to die. And we're out there for a while, like 35 minutes. And the only thing that allowed me to be in that space, to enjoy it, for it to become one of the most life-changing experiences, was that I was able to know and remind myself, I knew I was safe, I knew I could do it, and it allowed me to just have a truly life-changing experience. And it's still one that I draw on whenever I'm nervous, whenever I feel like I'm afraid to, have a conversation with someone, to confront someone, to, just small things. I think I hung over the side of a 117-story building. I can do this. And it works. So that's how awareness and attention play into when we love kind of thrills and chills. And I love this. Well, this is one of my favorite quotes, but also one of my favorite metaphors that through experience now seems to work really well with actors, especially that, when everything is in place, when you've got all of the safety measures, you've got the full scenic designs, you've got full immersion, the guests are like the kite, and the string is like the actors, the props, the sets and scenes, and the hand, the anchor is the company, the commercial industry, the business that you know is holding on to you, that you know has got you, because that's really the only way that you can kind of fly around and have the experience is when you know something is holding on to you. And this quote from Edmund Burke from 1757, when we have an idea of pain and danger without being actually in such circumstances, that is sublime. And so now we'll look at some of the ways that is sublime. And I think that, yes, I'll just go on from there. So first, everybody does talk about the physical benefits, the natural high. And, you know, it is a very real response that most of our bodies do go through when we're startled. The threat response is different from fear. You know, in emotions research now, there's a lot of emphasis and attention to differentiating these processes so everybody understands what they're studying and what they're talking about. So the physical response that happens under stress, you know, we refer to as the threat response. And these are just some of the neurochemicals that are involved. So the neurotransmitters and the hormones that start kind of coursing through our body. And when we're actually in threat or in danger, in pain, they're doing a lot of work. They're helping us, you know, manage those threats. When we're not, though, we can enjoy it. You know, it can feel euphoric, and we can feel strong and fast and focused. And this back my teenage self, when I was trying to figure out, you know, why I liked this stuff so much, I would tell my friends, I feel primal, I feel like an animal. And that is, you know, we have evidence to suggest that is because in these moments, we're really not thinking. And I'll talk about that a little more in a couple of slides. But in these moments, we're fully in our body, you know, where we're grounded in our body. And my best friend, she teaches yoga, and she's very, you know, she's all about meditation and just calm. And it's funny because, you know, we come together and it is very much oil and water, but we have the same goal of wanting to feel, you know, in our body, wanting to help people kind of connect mind and body. And we just come at it from two very different ways. But and that's, you know, one of the reasons that some people do like being scared is because this feels like the more natural route to that feeling. They may not be able to do the meditation and the yoga and that quiet. We need the, I'm just going to, you know, scare myself until I'm not thinking anymore. But there are psychological benefits as well. And this is coming from our research, you know, asking pre and post questions, asking how people feel, report feeling afterwards. And they report feeling confident and successful, competent, and even more resilient. And, you know, in this way, we can think about fun, scary activities as any other stressful challenge, like rock climbing or running a marathon. You know, we're taxing our body, we're pushing our body, we're taking on a challenge, and we're surviving. So evolutionarily, that means that we did something right. And so what we're looking at right now is how this is happening, you know, in the brain and body. Is it that we are, you know, recalibrating what is considered stressful? Is it because we just, you know, slayed a horde of zombies that now our coworkers aren't bothering us? You know, that we're resetting the bar, or are we building something up? You know, what is happening? And that's what that's what we want to, you know, find out more about, is how, what the mechanisms behind this are to lead us to feeling like this. And so now getting back to this idea of pressing reset, and this is another one of Misty's, but I was so, and I don't know if you knew this, Misty, that this was one that I designed and painted with the help of the creative team at Scarehouse. And so when I saw this in there, I was just so excited because I love this illusion so much. But when we are in this heightened stress state, when we're scared, when we're excited, when we're thrilled, we're reprioritizing where the focus is, and it's not on, you know, our thoughts. It's on our body. So What my colleague and I have found is that for people who are high ruminators, people who get very anxious, who do the kind of repeating cycling thoughts, that doing something, you know, that is activating that sympathetic nervous system that is taking the body all the way up is kind of a way to knock those thoughts out, because all attention is going to our body, is going to, you know, turning us into fighting or fleeing animals. So we're not thinking about the conversation that we wish we had, or things we wish we had said, or our finances, or what we're going to do tomorrow. We're endlessly making those lists in our minds. And it kind of, you know, this is oversimplified, but it's like an Etch-a-Sketch when you just kind of shake it and you can start over and reset. So, and I've put this to use for myself now. Whenever I find myself getting caught up in my mind, you know, if there's a pool around, I'll jump in a pool or do something, do a cartwheel, do anything to transition attention and focus to my body. So it's, I do tell people to do somersaults, because you're not going to be thinking about your bills after doing, you know, 10 somersaults in a row. So I encourage you to try it for yourself. But we do think that this is a way to kind of press reset, and for people, especially, you know, high ruminators, to get out of their head for a while. And then finally, there are many social benefits to doing fun, scary activities together. Some of you may recognize these photos every year. These are the photos from the haunted attraction up in the Clifton Hills district of Niagara Falls. Oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm blanking on it now. I can't believe I'm forgetting what the name of it is. Anyway, it's a completely blackout attraction. And then there's one point where this light flashes, and they take this photo. And it's another series that affective scientists love, because you can see so many different reactions to fear. And I just love it, because you can see, you know, this is what we do when we're afraid. We cling to each other, unless you're my friend Aaron, who is more interested in finding out what mechanism. He designs haunted houses, and he didn't want to get lost, so he's, you know, holding on to me. But he's like, what was that? How did that work? But for the most part, you know, we hide our faces, we cling to each other, and it brings us together. And there's chemicals that are associated with this as well. So oxytocin is just one that's been identified. There's also vasopressin, but these are related to pro-social bonding. However, recent research has shown that it can work the opposite too, so that if you're in a stressful situation, in a scary situation with someone that you don't like or don't trust, it can increase those defensive feelings, and you can feel even more distant. But if you're with your friends, you're with your family, these experiences are going to bond you more closely together. And to me, that highlights how we really do better together. You know, we've evolved to come together in these moments and to cling to each other. This, though, is also still culturally specific. When I was in Japan, you know, the way that groups went through haunted attractions there was in a more of a circular group, and after every startle, people got closer and lower. And it was, I watched about 10 different groups going through and doing the same thing, down, lower. And I thought that was really interesting. So we do learn, you know, even our expressions of fear from our culture. But, you know, this coming together is creating these shareable moments. We love to share stories. You know, humans, that's how we, you know, communication, storytelling, that's everything. And that's what, you know, what makes for a better story than something scary. And the other part of it is that when we are scared, we do form more layered, rich, detailed memories, because we want to remember what is going to kill us or help us survive. So we are going to remember our friends, and that's what brings us back year after year to haunted attractions and to, you know, annual traditions, is that nostalgia, that desire to kind of recreate that feeling. And so, you know, it does build a sense of solidarity, and this does go back to my earlier studies of fear as something that keeps people apart. You know, it's the other side of this, and this is what's so challenging for us today as a society, I think, is to understand how we can come together without necessarily coming together against somebody else. You know, figuring out how that works and what that balance is starts with understanding, you know, how fear works in culture and how it is kind of behind a lot of these processes that we see. So, you know, these are just some of the reasons that people love or you know, loathe these experiences. And I encourage, you know, one of my big goals now is just to encourage people to think about fear in their own life and to think about ways that it might be motivating you or, you know, driving your decisions, and to bring awareness to that so that you do have more say in, you know, what you want to do, that these aren't just decisions that are being made without your attention, but just based on kind of an abstract awareness, and to bring it into your own hands and kind of decide, you know, what you can grow from in terms of doing fun, scary things. So with that in mind, are there any questions? I'm happy to. I think I have like 5 minutes left, so if anybody has any questions, I am more than happy to answer them. And of course, I thank you all so much. Yeah?
You mentioned at the beginning of your lecture about the inverse, those who don't enjoy being scared. Could you talk a little bit about that and why some may choose to opt out of that behavior?
Sure. So in some of the research looking at, you know, what they refer to as stress sensitivity, finding the reasons behind why some people are more stress sensitive, it's a constantly evolving kind of area. I talked to one genetic researcher who did find relationships to genetic expressions, particularly with serotonin, and that, you know, people with certain expressions were more stress sensitive than others. The problem is, you know, and as she said, we knew more about serotonin and a lot of these neurotransmitters 20 years ago than we do today, because, you know, scientists are realizing that we only know about things that have been decided we should study. And so there's this big question of what we're missing, you know, things that have not been identified as being critical in these processes. So, you know, it's probably something linked to serotonin expressions. And, you know, serotonin is mostly thought of just in terms of treating depression. But now researchers are seeing that it's much bigger than that, that it's key in processing so many things, just sort of like the oil that keeps the brain kind of going. And that's oversimplified, but so that could have something to do with it. And definitely, you know, experiences with different types of content leave their mark, especially in childhood, pretty strongly. So if your experiences with scary material, whether it's haunted houses or scary movies, if you had a bad experience, that could stay with you. And each time it's brought up, could be reinforced. So every time a friend says, "No, don't you want to go?" And you're reminded, like, "Oh man, I saw Thriller when this really horrible thing happened," and you're reminded, and it's reinforced that it's a bad thing, and it just goes on from there. So I always encourage people, if they you know, we do kind of confirm this knowledge about ourselves, I think, too often without seeing if it's still true. You know, I've talked to people who will say, "Oh, I didn't really like scary movies until I saw this one, and then I realized that I kind of do." So I encourage people to kind of check in and see if, you know, what they think they don't like, they still don't like, or to be more selective. You know, there are a lot of horror movies that I don't like. The horror movie genre is vast. And often is a matter of how producers decide to categorize it, which is a huge issue right now with the movie Mother, the critics are saying this is a matter of miscategorization, that it shouldn't have been marketed as a horror movie, but something else. Because our expectations vary very powerfully define our experience, because we're always comparing to whether it's matched or not.
Would you mind talking a little bit as a sociologist about the difference between seeing the photographs upstairs and being in a haunted house?
Yeah, so this, I really have been thinking about it a lot today after talking with Misty about the difference between, or, you know, Misty was saying that we really can't create that feeling of going through a haunted attraction with a photo. And, you know, when we go through haunted attractions, we're not really meant to linger on these scenes for too long. They're meant to be experienced just like that because they're so heavy and they're so, well, scary. You know, you don't want to spend too much time in a room that's been made up to look like a mass murder has occurred, or, you know, you don't want to spend a lot of time in a butcher's shop with all these dead animals. You want to just kind of see it and then keep going. And, you know, we do that because we want to know, like, the attraction. We want to know, like, these are the things that are out there. I can tolerate it this much, and then I'm going to keep going, and then I'm going to laugh, and it's going to make me feel like I've got some kind of control. I've got some kind of sense. I understand it. I've moved on, and now I've, you know, created something positive out of it. Whereas with the photos, we're given the opportunity to really kind of go a little deeper, to think about what this means and what this is saying about us as a society, and also to dig into what we're really afraid of. You know, the scenes in attractions look very different in Japan than they do here. Our monster myths, our scenes, our scares are a reflection of who we are, of what we're afraid of. And, you know, the monster myths throughout time have always been this great mirror to society to kind of see what we're struggling with, what we're dealing with in this moment in time. And so, you know, in the photographs, we can think about that and get pretty deep with it and push ourselves to really kind of question what, you know, what we're truly afraid of, not just for ourselves, but for our family. And that's, I think, one striking thing that I see so often in haunted houses is that the scenes are so scary because they're often threatening people that we love. They're not necessarily, you know, threats to us. They're threats to the people we love. And, you know, so that's, I think the difference is that, you know, you are engaging with the material at such a deeper level, and a personal and cultural level, and you can have the time to do that. But it is a totally different experience than when you actually go through, and you just get that glimpse and then can move on.
Well, you know, I'm kind of falling back to questions in my mind about physiology again, and maybe a little sociology too, because it seems to me that most of your subjects that you've taken photographs are young, and you know, people with their friends, and I kind of wonder about the physiology of these stimuli as you get older, or say as you're taking medicines. There are a whole bunch of medicines that blunt the effect of neurotransmitters. What do you know about those things?
Well, I do know that the largest demographic that, you know, engages with this type of stuff is the 25 to, you know, 35, followed by 35 to 45. And there are the, you know, the young kids like it too, but by far, you know, just looking at surveys of people who are going to haunted attractions, it's usually, you know, the 25 and to 45. I do think that the physiology part of it, just our bodies in general, do play a big role. Especially when it comes to disorienting kinds of experiences. So as our vestibular system and our inner ears and things kind of start to degrade, it's not so much fun to feel that spinny feeling anymore. I used to love the Gravitron, and now I can't do it anymore. So I think that there is a change in how our body is responding, and that can influence our enjoyment of it. But when I, you know, I still think that there are ways that different age groups kind of are engaging with this type of stuff to sort of get the same kind of experience. When I went to the Edgewalk, I think that I was the second youngest there. And perhaps it was just the group I was with that day. That's just anecdotal evidence. But most of the people I was with were in their 40s and 50s. And so I think that it might just be a matter of kind of different activities that attract different age groups. But definitely the how people are going to experience it in their body is going to influence whether they leave kind of feeling great or feeling, you know, like they were hit by a truck. But that feeling can also take on a positive meaning if you feel like you've really kind of given it your all, sort of like at the end of a marathon. But yes, I think that it is, you know, important to think about how your body is changing. In the blue? Oh.
What does this overexposure or repeated exposure or addiction to fear do to empathy?
I think that's a really good question, too. And the studies that have looked at the consequences of playing violent video games show that a lot of it depends on age, too. So, you know, the age of the person who is playing them and broader context. You know, things like habituation, where we become used to something because we're experiencing all the time, desensitization, these are real things that happen. But whether or not that's corresponding with a decrease in empathy to actual people, the studies are mixed. We need to do more research on it. We've never, you know, had technology like this before with this type of exposure. You know, we can't compare it to previous, you know, human civilizations where war and brutality were very common because it's different. So, you know, if I think about ancient Greece and, you know, more violent times where people were being killed on the street daily right in front of you, and that is the reality for some people, you know, in the U.S. and definitely around the world today, that's different than being exposed, you know, on our phone and via technology. And so we need to figure out how that is changing us and what the main kind of driving mechanisms behind it are. You know, is this something that is linked to how we're consuming the information? Is it linked to the context of the information? But I think it's a good question. I don't think it's as easy, and I don't think research supports just saying, you know, overexposure leads to decreased empathy. I think that it's much more complicated. Misty?
I was wondering if you could talk about that scene from Scare House that you designed, because a lot of times when people have seen that photograph, they believe that it's a space, and it actually looks a lot like this artist, Yayoi Kusumi, who creates these environments.
Yeah.
So people are often surprised to find out that is a wall and not an actual space you walk through. But since you designed it, I was wondering if you could talk about why you created that in a haunted house.
Well, so I can't take credit for the actual, like, illusion of it, but the putting it, so right here, this is the seam of the wall right here. So that's the corner, and then it comes this way, and that's a door, and it keeps going. This is right before what's called a vortex, a spinning tunnel that you walk through. And I wanted to do something that really messed with our perception. So when we're in a high arousal state, when we're fully activated, we're not very good at perceiving the environment. So this is what's behind a lot of the, you know, sightings of things like Mothman or, you know, just monsters in general. We do tend to see things and perceive them as being bigger because we want to make sure that we're preparing at a metabolic level enough. So it's better to think, oh my God, this is going to be huge. So our perception is distorted when we're scared. So this is in the center of the attraction. So people ideally should already be pretty activated and get to this and think that they can keep walking and then walk into the wall. And this is in a UV lit. So this is, you know, in a 3D environment. So the white really looks like it's popping. And what I love is that moment when you realize that you were wrong about perception. What I always am teaching my students is to leave a door open to being wrong. And it's something that you don't see a lot in our leaders today, is this willingness to be like, oh, I was totally wrong. And this is a very basic, like, you thought that you could keep going and you couldn't. Your eyes, the thing that you trust so much to inform you about everything, can be wrong. So yes, you can absolutely be wrong about so many other things. So it's just that reminder that we shouldn't take for granted everything that we see as reality and assume it is true. And that it's really fun to play with our perception, that everything that we see is this construction, and there's so many points that we can intervene in to mess it up, whether it's with an illusion like this, or with lighting, or with sound, or all of these things we can manipulate in ways that we're not paying attention to have fun. So, one more question, I guess. Is that, in the back?
You've mostly been speaking about individuals on, like, the audience side or participants. Has any of your research been focused on, like, those who choose to create these environments and scare others? I'm thinking particularly of, like, some of the photos in the exhibitions. A lot of them are sort of, like, cookie-cutter, like, oh, well, just put some guts on the table. Like, very sort of, like, traditional scary things we think of.
Yeah.
From, like, a pop culture standpoint. But then there's other, like, real deeper fears that it seems to be tapping into. I'm thinking particularly of, like, the child, like, with all the missing posters and things, which really seems to tap into, like, a much darker, real fear. Have you focused at all on, like, the people that, like, how they create these and why they create them?
I only, kind of, I guess I would say casually. I haven't done any systematic analysis. I've done a lot of surveys with actors and, of course, lots and lots of conversations with many different haunted attraction owners and designers. And on the actor side, it's a lot of, they're entertainers. You know, it's they're entertainers who really like scary stuff. And it's, people who want to be in that environment with the guest to make them scream and laugh. And, being on the other end of doing a lot of hiring of actors, I have seen people who come in who, seem to express a desire to kind of just torture people or to make people feel bad. And those aren't the people that you want, on the other side of scares. You want the people who want, at the end of the day, the guests to have a really good time. And that, I would say, are the majority of actors who are in these spaces, or people who want to entertain. And, the way that we do understand each other, really empathy, is by recreating the experience within ourselves. So, for example, when the actor is popping out and scaring someone, their body is in that same kind of activated state, and they're excited too, and they're thrilled, and they're scared, and there's that anticipation, and all of those things are there for them too. And so it's a energizing, exciting experience for them as well. And I don't know how many actors have said that they've grown a sense of confidence in doing scare acting, that it has given them the confidence to speak up more through just doing this acting. So I think that there is a desire just to entertain, and that's combined with a joy of scary things. A lot of people, though, also just get into it because their friends do it. So these are groups that come together every year and create these amazing friendships. I don't know how many people have been in long-term relationships, found their spouses. I found mine, doing scary things. You kind of create these intense environments and you build friendships on the acting side as well. When it comes to motivation for the designers, it has been interesting to see kind of where those boundaries are, because there's lots of different types of designers, and I don't even think I could create, categories that would make sense to kind of group all the different types of designers that I've met. Some people really love the process of it, just from a set design perspective, it's gratifying to use the tools and to use the methods in creating these distressed looks. And so you see a lot of crossover with people who are into film sets and, you know, just kind of across the design category. The people who come up with like the storylines are incredibly imaginative, you know, very far more imaginative than me. Like when I think about designing scary stuff, I start with the scares. I start with what's going to, you know, scare people at a physiological level. So like there should be a startling sound here and then a physical startle from down here. And I think that way, but, you know, other people start with the story and just wanting to tell a really good story. And in that sense, they're like any horror writer or a filmmaker and just have creative minds and then turn to people with the skills to bring it into reality. And that's really, there's some super creative people out there. So, I think I'm out of time, but I'm happy to talk to folks. And if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to email me. I just want to thank the Modern so much and Misty and all of you. And I hope you have a great Halloween season. So.